Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I am very pleased to have with us a man who has been contributing mightily from a variety of vantage points of late to the war of ideas aspect of that battle space, at the very least. He is Ambassador Michael Oren, the former U.S. citizen turned Israeli ambassador to the United States, now a member of the Knesset, and the author of a best-selling book, indeed a barn-burning best-selling book, entitled Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. A timely book indeed, as we're at the moment at the end game of what the administration claims is its effort to conclude a deal with the Iranians on nuclear weapons, some of which it would seem have Israel's name on them. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is a delight to have a chance to talk with you, and congratulations on the publication of your new book and its very considerable success.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be with you, Frank.
I'd like to sort of begin with how we got here. You have done some almost psychoanalytic delving into the Obama mind and what opened it to the Muslim world and seemingly closed it to Israel. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it didn't say close it to Israel. It had a different worldview about Israel, which is very important to note. There's a part of the book where I talk about how I, as a former historian, came into an embassy in 2009, and I was working with a new administration with a president who wasn't well known. He hadn't been in public life that long, and it felt it was my duty to study him the way I would study an historical subject, to go back to the sources, to go back to the text. So I read everything he wrote about the Middle East, everything he was interviewed about the Middle East, things he particularly the books he wrote about himself. And you didn't have to speculate very much because he said a tremendous amount. He always talked about his deep connections to the Middle East, deep connections to the Muslim world, what he called the Muslim world. And people tend to forget today that even in the first inaugural address, his initial, his first interview on television was Al Arabiya television, his first trips abroad to Turkey and Egypt. He always talked about these family ties and how they influenced him. And it's kind of interesting now because I've been rather attacked for this. But I'm just quoting what he said. And by the way, there's another section of the book where I do a profile of Netanyahu, and I use the same methodology with him. I talk about the influence of his father, the influence of his brother. And this is the ambassador's job. I understand that the issue of the president's connections to his Muslim family have become controversial in the United States, but they weren't controversial in 2009, and he was quite proud of them. It just sort of fell off over the years, but that doesn't remove me from the responsibility, certainly as an author who's recounting contemporary history, to talk about the process that I used in order to get to a point where I say in the book, I would never be surprised by him, and it was largely successful.
And in the cumulative analysis that you've done, did you find an explanation for what amounts to, it seems to me at least, a kind of switching of sides in what's been called the war on terrorism? I think of it, as I said, as the war for the free world, because I really think that's what's on the line. Is it this sort of a nostalgic, sentimental attachment to Islam, or is there a notion of grand strategy that involves Iranian hegemony being a good thing and it being even a nuclear bomb-equipped hegemony at that?
Well, I won't sign on to the, you know, Obama switch sides thesis. And I say in the book again and again that I don't think he's anti-Israel. I think he's pro-Israel, though a certain type of Israel. Particularly the Israel that he thinks existed before 1967. Again, he has said this, and I personally think that Israel is a lot more liberal and democratic today than it was before 1967. But leaving that aside, again, the research. The research, the part about the Muslim family ties was a very small part of the research. Most of the research talked about and delved into Obama's academic background. Now, I've spent a lot of time on American campuses, and I knew the ideas that have been floating in American campuses for the last 30, 40 years. And many of the policies that the president embraced were not very surprising for me because I knew them. I knew them from the classroom. So what were they? No longer would America be the policeman of the world, the leader of the world. America would work in a collegial fashion with other powers. America would work with international organizations like the UN, and there's a tremendous emphasis on international organizations, including the Human Rights Council of the UN, which George Bush boycotted. He withdrew the America's ambassador from the Human Rights Commission, and Obama returned America's. We thought that an American presence there would lend legitimacy to what is inherently a rapidly anti-Israel body of the UN. It meant a certain recoiling from the use of military power, much less emphasis on the use of military power. Obama said publicly, again, I quote him, whether we like it or not, we're the world's leading military power, which I think says an awful amount. I think it's a great window into his thinking. All of these were part of worldviews that I understood very well from campuses, and you could trace them. And he taught and studied at urban universities where these ideas were the dominant ideas. And here they were put into action as policy. Many of them have collided with reality, particularly after the winter of 2011 and the Arab Spring, when the Middle East, as we had come to know it over the previous century, simply unraveled.
I guess I'd like to just ask in our closing minutes, Ambassador Michael Oren, what you make of the deal now shaping up with Iran and how those who have an attachment, not only to the security of this country, but also to Israel, should be viewing it through the prism of a much more realistic attitude than the president has struck.
Well, as you know, I am a member of Knesset, Frank, and I represent a certain party. But what's the most remarkable thing here is that in a parliamentary body where representatives agree on just about nothing, where the parties agree on just about nothing, here there's almost a national consensus that this is a very bad deal. And it's a bad deal that jeopardizes our security, our safety, and perhaps even our future.
And in light of that, what should be done, in your judgment?
Measures should be taken that bring the Iranians back to the table, that ramps up the pressure on them, both economic pressure and a credible military threat, that will bring about a better deal. The administration's position has been very binary. It's either you have negotiations or war. But I think it's a false dichotomy. There's, of course, another alternative, and that is more negotiations for a better deal. And the Iranians have proven that when you do turn up, you know, the pressure on them, you ramp up the pressure, they will be willing to make concessions. It's when you give them what they want that they actually will walk away from the table. I personally will not be surprised if the Iranians walk away from the table again, because they've been taught that the longer they hold out, the more concessions they get, which I strongly believe is exactly the opposite way to treat them.
Lastly, Mr. Ambassador, very quickly, the administration has been pushing back against this consensus, expressed most visibly by, of course, your Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, by threatening, either explicitly or at least off the record, retaliation by not standing with Israel at the Human Rights Council, perhaps, but more generally at the United Nations in the Security Council when the Palestinians seek recognition there. What would be the view of Israelis? Is that also a matter of consensus?
It is a matter of concern. And I think the vast majority of Israelis would view that as a very severe and damaging development if the United States would not stand with us there. There may be some radical left-wing parties who would applaud it, but they're a tiny minority in the state of Israel. And the expectation is that the United States will stand by not just us, but by its own commitments. According to the 1993 Oslo Accords, it says explicitly there is no alternative to direct negotiations to reach a peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The Palestinians are now moving unilaterally through the UN to achieve statehood without giving us peace. They're going to use that status not to get a better two-state solution, but to go to an international criminal court and sue us for war crimes. and sanction us. And those sanctions are not designed to get peace. They're designed to take us down, to destroy our economy. They're a strategic threat. So the United States should stand by its own commitments, by its own long-standing principles. Here I speak not just for myself and my party. I think I speak for the majority of Israelis.
Mr. Besser, congratulations again on your marvelous new book, Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. We look forward to talking with you further in the future and working with you in defeating this horrible deal with Iran. Next up, Garland Tucker, an author and business leader, will talk with us about conservative heroes. Where do we find them today? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war, from Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined, I'm pleased to say, by Garland Tucker. He is today the chairman and CEO of a publicly traded company, Triangle Capital Corporation. But he has come to our attention for his authorship of two very important books, The High Tide of American Conservatism and, most recently, Conservative Heroes, a subject we're much seized with at the moment, and we'll talk a bit about the seeming absence of many conservative heroes at present. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about some of those who have been prominent throughout the history of this country and done much to shape it. Garland Tucker, welcome. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Frank, thank you. Glad to be here.
So you've profiled 14 leaders who shaped America from Jefferson to Reagan in your book, Conservative Heroes. Give us a sense of what causes people to be characterized, first of all, as conservatives, I guess, but second of all, as conservative heroes.
Taking that in reverse order as far as heroes, I guess one of the fun things about writing a book like this is you get to pick your own heroes, and that's what I did. But as far as what makes a conservative, in the introductory chapter, I lay out five principles that I think are basic conservative principles that I think virtually all conservatives would agree on. And then beginning with Jefferson and Madison, I trace what it's like for leaders to live out those principles chronologically through American history, again, starting at the beginning of the Republic with Jefferson and Madison and winding up with Buckley, Goldwater, and Reagan in the last chapter. And let me hasten to say that when I say the last chapter, I don't mean the last chapter of conservatism. It's just the last chapter of the book. I hope there'll be plenty more chapters in the future.
Well, we're watching them being written today, and we'll again come to that in a moment. But we're visiting with Garland Tucker. He's a businessman by profession, but an author by avocation, including most recently a brand new book entitled Conservative Heroes, 14 Leaders Who Shaped America from Jefferson to Reagan. And you mentioned, Garland, five sort of qualities that you believe sort of define conservatism. Can you give us that in a very short form?
Absolutely, Frank. It begins with what I call a realistic view of human nature, sort of the conservative view of human nature. And then the things like the importance of limited government, the importance of private property, the importance of personal virtues, a republic that's based on really the individual virtues that its people have. And in our case, those are founded on what we call the Judeo-Christian philosophy. So these are just basic things that I think virtually all conservatives would have believed and continue to believe today.
Yeah, and they stand in stark contrast, of course, specifically the idea that man is perfectible, a not very realistic view.
Well, that's right. Liberals would say that that man is perfectible and government is the means of perfection, and conservatives would disagree.
And that private virtues really are not that important. It is sort of the common wheel that needs to be triumphant. I think these are really important points. And give us a flavor, if you would. Of course, one of my personal favorites among your heroes is Ronald Reagan. But maybe starting early on, the sort of contribution that these traits, these qualities, these priorities, if you will, of American conservatives did for the framing of our Constitution and founding of our country.
Well, you can go into the very first chapter, Jefferson and Madison. It focuses pretty narrowly on the 12 years before Jefferson was elected president in 1800. And those years, Jefferson and Madison were basically in the opposition to the Federalist Party that was in power. And they were very articulate in defining what they meant by limited government, and that became one of the foundation stones of American conservatism. I know we don't have time to go through all 14, but that's really, I think it's important that it's anchored back to the beginning of the Republic, and then the subsequent lives that I look at go chronologically through and wind up, as you say, with one of your favorites, Ronald Reagan.
And the importance of sort of the Judeo-Christian sort of principles is something I guess it would be also interesting to see. You know, Jefferson, I think, certainly was a man of faith, but took a view on all of this that is sometimes characterized as Judaism, I guess, rather than the Judeo-Christian tradition. Do you see it that way or not?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. But I think as a deist, Jefferson was very much in the Judeo-Christian tradition. He was not an Orthodox Christian, as probably as that would be defined today, but he was certainly very much grounded in the Judeo-Christian tradition, anyway, broadly defined.
And bring us sort of up to the moment. President Reagan, of course, was famous for both his commitment to conservative principles, but also a willingness to work across the aisle to get things done. Did he deviate from this tradition, or did he exemplify it, in your view?
Well, I think there's no question about his commitment to it. He did not have the luxury of controlling Congress, or the Republicans did not control Congress during Reagan's term. So he had to be practical as far as what he could accomplish and what he couldn't. In the last chapter, I really lump three men together, and I think it's hopefully helpful, and I think interesting. It's William Buckley, Barry Goldwater, and Ronald Reagan, and the lives of those three men were very much intertwined in the last half of the 20th century, and it really starts with Buckley when he came on the scene in 1950. Conservatism was at a pretty low ebb, and he virtually single-handedly became the voice of conservatism. And as he established the National Review and his speaking ability, debating ability, and became an intellectual force that played itself out in the political arena, first with Goldwater's nomination in 64. And even though he was totally unsuccessful at being elected, his campaign launched Ronald Reagan into his governorship of California and ultimately as president. And I think it's really the contribution of those three men that has put conservatism back in the mainstream of American history.
Do you see any heroes in the conservative world at this point, Garland Tucker? Or is the last chapter already written, or is it yet to be written?
I certainly don't think so. I think a couple of things are important. It's if you look back at effective conservative presidents, there are three in my book. It's Grover Cleveland, who was a Democrat, Calvin Coolidge, Republican, and Ronald Reagan. And I think it's interesting to realize that the general expectation before the election or selection of those three men as president was not particularly high. I don't think anyone expected any of those three men to be as successful in the presidency as they were. So, you know, we're never quite sure when we elect somebody whether they're going to be a hero or not. But I think, and then the second thing I would say is, the Republicans right now have, I don't know how many candidates.
I think it's 13 with Bobby Jindal getting in today, but it'll be more before it's done. That's for sure.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is that virtually every single candidate is at least saying that he or she is a conservative. And that's a tribute, I think, to Buckley and Reagan and Goldwater and their establishing conservatism.
We will see if they measure up, though, that's for sure, heroically or otherwise. We have to leave it at that. Garland Tucker, again, thank you very much for this important new contribution to our thinking about what we need as a governing body, namely more conservative heroes. The title of his new book, Conservative Heroes, 14 Leaders Who Shaped America from Jefferson to Reagan. We appreciate very much you taking the time and look forward to talking with you again in the future. We'll talk next with John Sitalides about the future of Greece and what it might mean for all of us straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We hear a lot about the danger posed by Islamic supremacists overseas, like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, and their determination to use violence to impose their totalitarian Sharia program worldwide. A new poll of American Muslims suggests that astonishing numbers of them here at home are problematic, too. For example, nearly 1 in 5 of the 600 Muslims surveyed agreed that, quote, the use of violence in the United States is justified in order to make Sharia the law of the land in this country, unquote. Far more disagreed, but many thousands may feel this way. Americans, both Muslim and non-Muslims alike, who love this country and wish to protect it against toxic ideologies like Sharia, must recognize this reality and join forces to defeat the threat thus posed. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Check out the complete poll at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. At the G7 summit in Germany this week, President Obama said this about his strategy to take on ISIS in Iraq.
When a finalized plan is presented to me by the Pentagon, then I will share it with the American people. It's not, we don't yet have a complete strategy.
How can President Obama in June 2015 still not have a plan to deal with ISIS in Iraq? After all, he also said this in August 2014. The truth is the president does have a strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It's to put significant restrictions on U.S. troops and to do as little as possible so he can say he's a president who got the United States out of wars, not into one. Ultimately, the president wants to hand this mess to the next president. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back joined by John Sitalides, one of the country's foremost authorities on matters involving Greece and the Eastern Mediterranean. Today he is a principal in Trilogy Advisors, LLC, which is a federal government affairs and public policy firm. He is also a consultant to the Department of State on European diplomacy. Been involved for many years with the State Department, its professional development program for U.S. diplomats in Greece and Cyprus, also in conjunction with the program on Turkey. He has been, as well, the board chairman of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Southeast Europe Project. He is a man we turn to for explication of what is going on with respect to particularly Greece and its economic difficulties at the moment, and what's going on with the Europeans as they try to address this very difficult situation. John, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Frank. Thank you.
Well, I've been trying to stay abreast of what's developing in terms of the back and forth between the Europeans who are insisting on austerity and the Greeks who are insisting on a relief from austerity. What is your current reading of the negotiations and their prospects?
I'd like to say, Frank, that we do not have an immovable force to work with right now, but yes, the European creditors are seeking greater fiscal discipline on the part of the Greek state, specifically to avoid the repeat of what crisis led to all of this back in 2009. essentially with Greece being a statist economy that has been hostile to free market principles and to competitiveness and to improving labor productivity, largely in support of a clientelist state where the public sector feeds special interests throughout the economy. And of course, this particular Greek government, comprised of radical left elements, including openly and avowed communist, Marxist-Leninist, and Trotskyite elements, is completely hostile to any type of serious structural reform or change to the clientele system, and would like significant debt relief from the European creditors and additional euros to be able to further expand the bloated public sector and an unproductive bureaucracy. So this immovability is a very serious issue on both sides, and geopolitically also has larger consequences for U.S. power projection in the Eastern Mediterranean and throughout the periphery.
Yeah, I want to come back to that, but just staying with the internal domestic character of this government in Greece, I guess statism is kind of what they're all about. And it's not just that they're, well, asking for debt forgiveness or relief of some kind. They're kind of demanding it, as I understand it. Is that fair?
I think this particular government has been quite adamant about it. And it's a different type of government that we've had in Greece since January of 2015. Even when we had center-left and center-right coalition governments from 2009 till January of this year, you did have efforts, half-hearted, so to speak, efforts on behalf of reform, but there was a sense that they understood that Greece had a responsibility to the creditors so that there was some type of conditionality where Europe would provide for financial assistance for Greece to help ride through this crisis. And Greece, in return, would enact reforms, which they did, but of course the failure was in implementing them after the enactment. This particular government, though, Frank, is very different than any government we've seen in Greece, not only in the last half decade, but really since the restoration of democracy in 1974 after the collapse of the Greek colonels and the junta. It is a government that is dedicated to communist and radical leftist principles. And I often wonder to what extent the European creditors in the European Commission and the European Central Bank, and for that matter in the IMF, recognize that there is an ideological and philosophical chasm between European and Western creditors and this particular government that is going to be extraordinarily difficult to bridge in the next few days.
It raises a question of even the willingness to bridge on the part of the Greeks. There have been some noises made, John, about turning to Russia for relief. I'm not sure that the Russians are in much of a position to bail out a bankrupt Greece, as they're having their own very acute economic difficulties, as you know. But how serious do you think that play is, and what might it portend for this, well, at least nominally, NATO member government, should it align much more closely with the Russians in the future?
It's absolutely essential that Washington, especially through its relationship with the IMF, take into fullest consideration the possibility that Russia will complicate matters in the course of these debt crisis negotiations. As you correctly note, Russia doesn't really have the capacity to bail out Greece. I mean, this is a country that owes its creditors about $250 billion, most of which will probably never be paid back over the next 20 to 30 years. But what Russia can do is to provide very targeted, tactical relief and assistance. For example, now there are discussions between Moscow and Athens on building a quote-unquote Turkish stream pipeline that would provide natural gas to European markets in place of the South Stream pipeline that had been rejected by European countries several months ago. And this would allow Russia to bypass Ukraine and still be able to provide natural gas to Europe at a time when Washington is looking to encourage Europe to wean itself from dependence on Russian natural gas. And so if Greece starts to become a weak link inside of NATO in support of Russian energy and geoeconomic interests, that becomes a long-term strategic problem for the U.S. inside the NATO alliance. And even more importantly, Frank, The United States and the West have one single naval facility now in the entire Eastern Mediterranean region that is aflame with developments in Turkey and Syria and Egypt and Libya, the migration crisis. And that one naval facility in Souda Bay on the Greek island of Crete is one that the Russians might lean in on the Greeks and say, listen, we're very happy to support you financially and help you out of this crisis, but we'd like to see a diminution of the U.S. presence and U.S. operational activity on this island, which would be severely injurious to U.S. power projection in the Eastern Mediterranean, and coupled that with Putin's desire to establish a working 16-ship Russian Mediterranean task force in the same area that he would seek to weaken the U.S. presence. So there are some very important geopolitical considerations in the context of Greece's debt negotiations.
Yeah, again, our guest is John Sitalides. He is one of the country's foremost thinkers about and influential figures on matters involving the Eastern Mediterranean, now a principal with Trilogy Advisors. And John, just to drill down on that for a moment, I think most Americans are unaware of how dynamic things have become in the Eastern Mediterranean. You've indicated a couple of flashpoints, not least this refugee crisis for the Europeans. But the likelihood that Putin will throw his weight around and will do so at our expense, especially if he has a willing partner in the prime minister and other government entities in Greece, really, it's hard to overstate the implications of that.
It's of great concern, even if one looks back into recent history, where because of the shared sense of religious history in that Greece is a Greek Orthodox country, Russia has an Orthodox Christian history dating back a millennium, and even though Putin really doesn't take his religious considerations very seriously, he has exploited those ties where people in other countries believe that there is an Orthodox unity here that can be played, and I believe that Putin is ready to exploit that and to manipulate that sentiment so that the Greek people might support the Greek government if they felt that they had no recourse but a fallback that involved Russia rather than Germany or Brussels.
One concern, of course, is in situations like this is miscalculations as well. And if the Russians are emboldened by the opportunity to sort of finesse the United States and NATO out of their Cypriot base and insert their new Mediterranean task force, it is entirely possible, especially with some of the drama that's taking place in Syria, among other hotspots, it really does raise a concern that I think deserves our close attention. John Sitalides, we appreciate you applying yours to it and sharing it with us from time to time. We'll look forward to talking with you again about it very soon. Keep up the good work in the meantime, and thanks for joining us. Next up, Fred Flights join us. We'll talk a little bit more about Iran and whether we should pay ransom for hostages. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. My colleague Fred Fleitz, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, a career intelligence professional with long service to the Central Intelligence Agency, also as John Bolton's chief of staff at the State Department and as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee, is with us for a further discussion of what is going on in these negotiations with Iran. Fred, good to have you with us, as always.
Good to be here, Frank, but I think Ambassador Oren's going to be a hard act to follow.
Well, I know that you will flesh out some of the points that that he was making, and I'm delighted to have you. And specifically, Fred, I guess I'm anxious to get your thoughts on what now seems to be an accelerating series of concessions the United States is making in the so-called end game of this negotiation. This is not surprising given sort of the pattern of this negotiation to this point. But what's happening at the moment, Fred, and what are its implications?
Well, there's two sets of concessions we're aware of, Frank. One of them came out in a Middle East Media Research Institute report or memory early in the month that the administration had proposed to write off an IAEA dossier of past nuclear weapons-related work by Iran and to agree to not inspect military and non-declared nuclear facilities if Iran would agree to a handful of token inspections of nuclear facilities, maybe one or two military, and a couple of discussions with Iranian scientists. And this, and it was part of this deal was that the U.S. will rely on intelligence means to confirm, to inspect non-declared facilities in the future rather than relying on IAEA inspectors. Well, Khamenei, Supreme Leader Khamenei, reportedly rejected this concession. Well, last week, it seems that John Kerry agreed to concede this to the Iranians anyway, when he said, we're not going to be obsessed with the past. He also said, we know what they did, and we have absolute knowledge with respect to certain military activities in which they were engaged. So that's the first set of concessions we can discuss. The other one, which came out this week in an associated a press report, is that the U.S. is going to offer advanced nuclear technology to Iran, probably light water reactors, as part of this agreement, which is really a stunning concession that no one knew was on the table.
Let's come back to that in a moment. But just staying with the first point, Fred, you have, as I've indicated, spent much of your professional life studying, among other proliferation concerns, those involved with Iran. When John Kerry says we have absolute knowledge of what has been taking place in secretive military facilities that have been off limits to IAEA inspectors and essentially very hard targets for U.S. intelligence for a long time, what do you make of that kind of representation?
My jaw dropped when I read that. I think it's fairly well known, even for people who don't follow this, is that we do not have absolute knowledge of covert nuclear programs, either in Iran or North Korea. Almost all of Iran's nuclear facilities associated with weapons were told to us by an Iranian opposition group, the NCRI. We know there are facilities in North Korea that the intelligence community knew nothing about until the North Koreans told us about them. The idea that we have perfect knowledge is laughable.
If it weren't so serious, it'd be laughable. It really does seem to me this is yet again an instance of national security fraud being perpetrated by the Obama administration, deliberately misleading the American people with a false sense of security about something that is certainly anything but. And Fred, turning to the other question, we have, of course, been engaged in various kinds of nuclear agreements over the years, enabling quite a number of countries to have access to American nuclear reactor technology and the like. What sets this particular proposed concession apart?
Well, I want to get to that, but I want to first say concerning national security fraud, inspections of these facilities are very difficult, and the evidence is often ambiguous. You really need on-the-ground inspectors to confirm nuclear weapons-related activity, especially in a state with a record of violating treaties. Now, concerning this nuclear technology being offered to Iran, it appears that this is going to be in the form of light water reactors, which are considered proliferation-resistant. That doesn't mean they are proliferation-proof. In fact, they produce significant amounts of plutonium if operated in a certain way. The fuel rods are removed from the reactor early. So if relations with Iran took a downturn, or if they simply decided to use these reactors for weapons, they could get significant amounts of weapons-grade plutonium from light water reactors. I mean, in my view, Iran has forfeited any right to peaceful nuclear technology until it owns up to its record of weapons-related work. And it looks like we're not going to make them do that.
And I guess, Fred, this is of concern for two reasons. One, the obvious one being the nature of the regime in Tehran and what it will do with this kind of capability, plutonium most especially. The other, though, has to be what it means for other aspirants to nuclear capabilities, weapons or otherwise. And what kind of, you know, shift would this mean almost certainly in our dealings with other nations, particularly ones that may not be as hostile to us as Iran?
Well, first of all, we're legitimizing a nuclear program that was built in secret in defiance of UN resolutions and in defiance of Iran's treaty obligations. And second, the Bush administration began a strategy after Iran's nuclear program was revealed in 2003 of not letting Iran, not letting any nation to enrich or develop plutonium, to reprocess plutonium, basically stop the spread of this technology. The Obama administration backed away from that policy in 2011, which was a serious mistake. But Congress is insisting that that standard be maintained. And there have been letters on a bipartisan basis saying to the Obama administration, you have to maintain what they call the gold standard in stopping the proliferation of enrichment and plutonium reprocessing technology. We'll never get another agreement with another nation barring them from enriching uranium or reprocessing plutonium if this agreement with Iran goes through.
Yeah, and that should be a very considerable concern to all of us who believe that this kind of cascading proliferation can become an enormous national security problem, not just for us, but for many of our allies and interests around the world. Fred, let me turn finally to a topic that has burst into our consciousness because the president saw fit to change policy of the United States government, namely with respect to how we deal with those who take Americans hostage. Talk a little bit about what might flow from this shift announced yesterday by President Obama.
Well, I'm sort of two minds on this. On one hand, I'm very concerned that it could open the floodgates for Americans to be taken hostage. But on the other hand, although the Obama administration claims that the U.S. government never pays hostages or negotiates hostages, we all know that we do, that we traded five Taliban prisoners for Bo Bergdahl. There was another incident a few years ago where there were American hikers taken prisoner in Iran. Clearly, we paid a ransom for them. It was called a bail offered by the country of Oman. There's other instances like this where we've made shortcuts, and frankly, I think terrorists know that we're doing this. It concerns me that this legitimates a program that will encourage Americans to be taken hostage. But I also think there's a bit of hypocrisy with what the president said.
In that he said the government won't do it, but individual family members are free to do it from here on out, I take it.
Well, basically saying that this is a big shift in policy, you know, that we will now sometimes negotiate with terrorists when we've been negotiating with terrorists for a long time.
Right. We will be watching this closely, as I know will you. Fred Flights, thanks for all you do for us at the Center for Security Policy. Keep it up and come back to us again soon. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.